Are you able to share with us, do we know about all of the, because you said they only need to get lucky once. Do we know about many of the near misses? You know, are these people, have there been recent near misses?
Well, it's been out there in the public domain. I mean, we don't hide this stuff. We've had, for example, in May, we had the device planted at Brompton Park, which was clearly an attempt to murder a police officer who would have been engaged in policing up around Tweddell and Ardoyne and the ongoing protests.
I'm talking more about aborted operations where maybe your force doesn't get the praise that you should be getting. Major aborted operations that you've been able to intercept.
No, well, there is a significant level of disruption that goes on that doesn't always, for good reason, reach the airwaves. But in the majority of cases, we want to do good civic policing. That means you go, gather the evidence and present that to the prosecutor. Arrest people and see them through court. And that's the main thrust of our strategy in tackling this terrorist problem.
And give me a sense of the nature of this terrorist problem as you describe it. Are your officers, for example, on the beat? Are you telling those officers that they are being targeted? Are they under a serious threat of attempted assassinations on them when they're on the beat? Is that the type of threat we're looking at in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, we have. I don't want to get into the detail, which I'm sure you'll understand, but where we're aware of threats against police officers who are going about frontline, very open, visible service to the community, and when we do from time to time get intelligence that tells us that those people are being targeted, we will tell them. And we will
targeted for assassination?
Yeah, I mean, these violent dissident Republican groups want to murder police officers and other people connected to the criminal justice system, like prison officers and so on. And we have a responsibility to share information with people who may be the subject of those attacks so that they can look after themselves and we can look after them as well. They do work for us.
Is that happening on a regular basis?
Yeah, well, on a routine basis, we would be providing briefings to officers about what the threat to them is. That's the way it has been for a number of years. And unfortunately, while this small but dangerous group of people still want to inflict harm on society through causing harm and murder of police officers, then that's going to need to be the case.
I would like you to share this figure with me. I'm not looking for a precise number, but I'm looking for a sense, because I think the public have an entitlement to know. Maybe it'll make them appreciate the risk that your officers are going through every single day of the week. Like, are there hundreds of credible, serious assassination attempts on your officers a year? Are we talking about a few a year, or, you know, it gets close? Or what are we talking about here to give us a sense of where we're at in Northern Ireland with these dissidents?
Well, there's lots of levels and stages of planning and fulfilment of these terrorist operations, so it's almost impossible to quantify that.
What a serious threat is.
Well, what we do know is that in the last 5 months, we've had six attempts by way of explosive device or gunfire or other serious determined attempts to murder police officers. You know, that's happening. You know, 6 in 6 months is a pretty significant figure. If it was happening anywhere else in the UK, I think it might have a higher media profile than that. On top of that, we know that there have been other attempts to do harm to police officers that we've been able to police out by saturating areas with high numbers of high visibility police. We know that there have been other things that we've been able to do covertly but in a measured way that has disrupted terrorist activity. Clearly, we're not going to talk about the detail of that. But even if you just look at the headlines of what has been reported through the BBC and other media outlets, we are looking at six attempts to murder police officers in the last 6 months.
So all they've got to do is get lucky once, as you say.
Well, that's the way, in their terms, lucky ones. And that is a concern to me, and that's why our officers need to be properly trained, briefed, equipped. But most of all, we actually need support from communities, because it's only when the communities see something, and this happens to a large extent, when a lot of the information that we get doesn't come from some sort of paid informant or some sort of tactical means of gathering intelligence. A large amount of the information that we get that disrupts these violent dissident groups comes from within those communities.
What about the loyalist paramilitary threat? How active are they?
There's no doubt about the activity of some loyalist paramilitary groups who are involved largely in organised crime and human trafficking and drugs importation and racketeering and all the rest of it, and we will continue to tackle that.
Are they growing in number? Young people joining their ranks? Are you as concerned as you are with the young people joining dissident ranks? Or is that part of the old brigade, if you like, continuing to do what they've always done?
Well, there's always the danger of young people through some sort of misplaced romantic view of the world of being drawn towards these groups. But we're not seeing massive recruitment into them. We are doing a huge amount of work with community representatives to reduce the vulnerability of young people drifting in that direction. And so, therefore, through our neighbourhood teams and areas where these groups exist.
All of those areas where your budgets are going to be reduced, but we've dealt with that.
Yeah, well, we've talked about what I'm saying is, though, that we are prioritising our budget into the places of highest risk and harm. And that in effect, means the areas that are most likely to be affected by paramilitary activity, whether it's violent dissident Republicans or loyalist gangs.
You just said their loyalists are involved in human trafficking, didn't you?
I did, yes. Yeah.
To what extent?
Well, around prostitution schemes and internal trafficking within the UK, for example. It's another element of organised crime. A large number of
that sounds like a mafia type organisation. Well, nothing to do with politics.
Well, it's not, and I'm not pretending that it does. A large.
So it is
amount,
a mafia type.
Well, I wouldn't rate them that highly, frankly. what I would say.
What
is
are they?
That
how would you describe them?
I would say that they are organised crime groups that still carry the flag of loyalist paramilitaries. That's how I would describe them. And they're disparate, they're disaggregated. I think the leadership of these paramilitary groups at the top level aren't necessarily agreeing or condoning or authorising any of this activity, but lots of these splinter groups in specific areas are effectively just organised crime groups.
And we're
going to pursue them to take their assets off them, to gather evidence against them, to lock them up, and to unashamedly make their life difficult, because they're a scourge on these communities.
And they're still extorting money out of businesses? Is the racketeering still going on? Protection money?
There is still evidence of that happening.
So they're not that disorganised, Chief Constable?
Well, I've said they're operating effectively as organised crime groups under a flag of convenience of loyalist paramilitary groups in some cases.
So they would have, is it fair to say, like the old days, we know this happened? I'm trying to get, again, a feel for how much things have changed, where they could have whole communities of businesses on certain roads so fearful that they have to pay them or they're burnt out. Is that still happening?
Well, it's a huge generalisation. I'm not aware of whole streets of businesses.
You know what I'm saying.
I mean, we've been tackling these groups in an organised way, both covertly through our colleagues in Crime Operations Department and very robustly through uniform, visible policing in these areas. We're going to continue to do that, and we will do everything that we can within the law to make their life difficult because they are a scourge on communities.
Yeah, I know that, and everyone knows that, but I just don't hear of very many prosecutions for people who are going in and extorting money out of businesses, the so-called protection racket. I don't hear of very many successes that you've had over recent years.
Okay, well, I mean,
can you name any?
Yes, I can. I mean, there have been a number of cases where we have managed to bring people before the court for blackmail, for extortion and so on. I don't have specifics.
Are you winning the war against them is what I'm really asking.
Well, do you know what? This isn't actually just about the police. This is about the communities themselves not accepting the power and influence that these organised crime groups, these loyalist paramilitary gangs are wanting
come
to
on,
influence.
Come on. It's not as easy as that.
Well, it's not as easy as that. But
in a community, though, and you've got these thugs, these gangsters, who are going to put a brick through your window, they're going to burn you out, they're going to do whatever they do to intimidate you. What do you do? What do you do? Do you really turn to the police?
Well, that's
because you can't be there 24 hours a day, and this is the dilemma. I'm not saying it's your fault, but what do you do?
Well, we're tackling this at a number of levels, right from, you know, making sure that people are operating within the law and how businesses are run. Some of these groups are trying to run quasi-legitimate businesses. So, for example, we've been seizing gaming machines where people don't have licences for them. We have been seizing cars, we've been seizing assets, we've been doing everything that we can to disrupt their criminal activity, to disrupt the influence, the negative influence that they have in communities. And the point that I'm making is a more general one, that we need community leaders, civic leaders, members of community to stand with us and to resist the influence that these groups bring in these vulnerable communities.
But you're not tough enough, as in you're not effective enough. Let's take paramilitary-style shootings as an example. Now, how damning is this, Chief Constable, of you and your force? You have not solved one paramilitary-style shooting in the last 3 years. Since 2012, 85 people have been shot in Northern Ireland. You haven't charged, not one person's been charged, not one person has been prosecuted in 3 years.
Well,
now, that's failure, is it not?
It's not failure. It's hugely challenging, but also your assertions are wrong.
But challenging is a term of a politician.
No.
Don't be a politician with me this morning.
I'm not. Listen.
That's disappointing.
After the event, it is hugely challenging to get people to step up and provide evidence. Very often they know the identity of the people who meted out these attacks on them. What we have had is a number of very successful operations and convictions for people who have appeared in court, been charged, been convicted of offences like possession of an offensive weapon in suspicious circumstances, possession of firearms with intent to endanger life. Very serious offences. Now, we know from an intelligence perspective that they're actually on their way to do punishment shootings. We can't prove that to an evidential standard. There has been a huge amount of disruption and activity to deal with this issue of what are called punishment attacks, punishment shootings.
But if you know in some of these cases that they are on their way to do punishment-style shootings, can you not have the resource to follow them, to have covert operations, and to be able to prosecute for more than just carrying a firearm offence? Can you not?
Well, we do all of that to an extent, Stephen, but we're not actually going to wait and let them do the punishment shooting before we intervene.
Of course you're not.
So if you take action before the point that the punishment shooting takes place, then you're left with, you can only present to the court what evidence you have. And that's just the reality.
You've described punishment attacks as a severe form of child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Those are your words.
Yes.
And you haven't successfully brought one prosecution in 3 years for these people who are committing a severe form of child abuse.
No, what I'm saying is that we have prosecuted people, but we have intervened to prevent them doing the punishment attack, doing the child abuse, if that's what we're going to call it, because it often is because of the age of the victims. We have intervened at times successfully to stop them doing that, and we have to go with whatever evidence is therefore available to us, and that will be possession of weapons or other type of less serious charges.
It comes back to what I was saying earlier on, and this is not something that you can solve, and I'm not suggesting it is. It's for us all in the community. But these people who are being shot in the ankles, shot in the legs, they are so fearful of the thugs and the gangsters because of the power that they still have that they can't even trust the police with the evidence. They can't trust the court, and they can't trust us as a society to protect them because the thugs have the upper hand.
Well, that's your view. I don't necessarily disagree with it. I think that just behoves all of us to work together to make sure that these people don't have that level of influence and can't intimidate communities to that level. But that's not a job for the police alone. There's a need for political and civil and civic leadership around all of this.
Last year, marching season, the so-called unionist graduate response led to a peaceful marching season. What are you expecting this year?
Well, I'm hopeful that we can get to a similar place. I do think there was responsible leadership that came from the loyal orders and from unionist loyalist politicians. And I don't see why they shouldn't exercise the same influence again this year.
Well, you're not confident, though, are you? Because you told the Irish News that you have concerns about disorder this 12th of July. Why did you say that?
Well, we have concerns every 12th of July. We know, I mean, you just need to look back to the year before last, in 2013, when we had a very difficult summer and there was violence on our streets. So I'm not complacent about it. We're planning.
It's not about complacency. You're a pretty skilled operator insofar as this morning you've been very skilled at giving messages of reassurance. So you would not be telling a newspaper that you have concerns about disorder if something hadn't changed from the relative pace of last year.
No, Stephen.
Well, let me ask you, has it changed? Have you more concerns this year than you did last year? There's the question.
No, I think this time last year we were pleading to leaders within unionism, within loyalism, within loyal orders to exercise influence, to reduce tension, to ensure that parading and protest activity was both lawful and peaceful. It's exactly the same plea this time. But you and I both know that policing in this environment, it's a hugely dynamic, volatile operating environment, and small things can have big consequences. And all I'm saying is that I'm expecting people, I'm asking people of influence to exercise that influence for good so that we don't end up with disorder on the streets, either communities fighting with each other or, as normally happens, one or both communities fighting with the police. That's not success for anyone, and it'll not help any parading issue. It'll not make any protest issue more effective by fighting with the police.
And what's your intelligence feeding back to you? Are people trying to stir it up?
I'm not telling you.
That was pretty stern.
I'm not going to talk about intelligence.
Someone spoke to me, a guy that was a headmaster or my mother. I'm not telling you. Why not?
No, look, listen.
What's intelligence telling you?
What's the last 40 years told us? The last 40 years has told us that this is a very volatile environment, that the parading season brings with it challenges. It's sometimes difficult to predict. But what we do know is that when responsible leadership comes from people like the Orange Order, from the unionist politicians, from loyalist community reps, that has influence for good. And my plea to them is that they act in that mature, responsible leadership function that they did last year that gave us a relatively peaceful summer.
What about political instability? Does that feed into that when we look at the institutions, when we see them squabbling with each other to the extent where, you know, the executive might fall? Does that political instability feed into some type of vacuum which affects stuff on the street?
Yeah, I think there's no question that when you end up with a lack of political consensus, that a vacuum gets created that raises tension that often plays itself out in the street. That's my analysis of it, and that's why I think our politicians have come a long way, and I welcome that.
So you're concerned about the current political instability?
Well, of course I am, like every other citizen. I mean, I'd far rather see political progress and consensus so that we can continue to make the progress that has been on the journey for the last 20 years.
But from
a policing perspective, when there is political stalemate, when there's political vacuum created, there is a history, there is a pattern that ends up manifesting itself in raised tension and plays itself out on the street.
So if the executive were to fall, which to a certain extent is none of your business, none of my business, if it falls, that's the political manifestation of whatever they do or don't agree up there. But if the executive were to fall, what implications do you think that would have for the police, for it manifesting itself on the streets of Northern Ireland? Well, obviously we don't know, but what's your guess?
Well, look,
would you be able to feel it?
I think it depends on how the politicians behave and the leadership that they give. Now, it may be that for political reasons that are none of my business, actually, that executive stops to function, say, in the worst-case scenario. That doesn't necessarily mean that those political leaders are without influence. These are people who are listened to. These are people who have influence in communities, who have an ability through their language and through the appeals that they make to reduce or to raise tension.
No, I hear that.
And regardless of what happens in Stormont, The influence of those political leaders is still critical to a peaceful and lawful summer.
I hear that. But if the executive were to fall, would it cause more problems on the streets?
Well, you know, I have said that whenever there is a political vacuum, then the history shows us that it manifests itself in raised tensions and it plays out on the streets. But, you know, a lot of this has got to do with how the politicians would react if, in your hypothetical situation, the executive fell.
Let's see how hypothetical it is.
Well, so be it. But even if that happens, you know, that does not prevent political leaders from exercising the good influence that we saw them showing last year. Real, responsible, mature leadership that actually, I think, was instrumental, was key to bringing about a lawful and peaceful parading season.
Well, I'm talking about other issues. Sometimes they aren't discussed in an interview like this. And with 5 minutes left, thank you for spending an hour with us this morning. You should come back more often. The police have to attend 24 incidents involving people with mental health issues every day. Do you think it's acceptable, again, as a society, that it seems to be the police that are being used for this type of care in the community?
Well, very often the police are the point of first and last resort. So we will respond initially. We like to have, without being mental health experts, enough training and awareness to be able to identify mental health issues for what they are rather than misinterpreting them into some sort of criminal activity.
24 incidents every day, though, is shocking.
Well, it is. And I think it's important that we work collaboratively with health and with other departments to make sure that we've got the best possible response to that. The interesting thing in a statistic like that is it's not captured in any of the targets for which I'm held to account. So we have a huge amount of police time that goes into dealing with people with mental health issues, people who are suicidal, people who are missing, none of which is captured, or there's no targets around. There's no performance accountability through the policing board for it. They're aware that we do it because we do demand analysis and explain it. But these are the elements of policing that are pretty important because they're key to keeping people safe, but they're not captured in crime statistics or performance statistics. But you know what? If a member of my family had a mental health problem and needed an intervention, I would hope that the police would come and deal with that and deal with it and point them towards the help that they need within the health and social care system.
What are you, a year in the job now?
Almost.
How close?
At the end of June, so 11 months, yeah.
Has it changed your life, being Chief Constable?
Yeah, it has. Not in a way that I hadn't anticipated or thought through.
How has it changed your life?
Well, I mean, you're undoubtedly a public figure. There are a number of people out there who...
You're out on Twitter and things. You like that. You're
visible. I mean, look, clearly I made a choice when I applied for this job. If I wasn't prepared to live with that and to change my lifestyle in that way, then I wouldn't have applied for the job. So I'm not complaining about that. There's the issue of just being the Chief Constable and dealing with the security issues that are associated with that, which is a life changer and can be quite intrusive.
Well, you said you like going to the supermarket. Must be a nightmare for your security team.
Well, all of those things are just the practical arrangements that we need to work around. But you know what? I'm not complaining. I'm hugely honoured to hold this job. Every day is a challenge. It's not easy, but it's actually... There's nothing happening that I didn't expect. I'm not talking about the issues. I'm talking about the challenge and the demands of the job.
Do you get many sleepless nights?
No, look, listen, the thing is...
Because it is a big job, George.
It's a massive job, but you know what? I'm part of a brilliant team, both at the senior level and right down to those officers, those constables and sergeants.
But don't be giving me all that glossy brochure stuff. I'm trying to find out about you.
Well,
you know, when you have
I have sleepless nights? No.
Okay.
But I don't have a problem sleeping. But I do have huge confidence in the team that operates with me, in our district commanders, in the people that carry risk in Crime Operations Department. Hold them in total admiration. They're my heroes. And that's why I have the confidence to do this job.
What's the biggest pressure of the job for you personally?
It's probably time and making sure that I'm putting the time to the things that are important and the things that the public expect.
What do you do to relax?
I'm very conscious that I am a public servant. I'm very conscious that the public have expectations.
Now, we're in the glossy brochure speaking.
No, we're not. No, I can't always meet those expectations, but I'm going to do everything within my power while I'm Chief Constable to do that.
What do you do to relax?
Well, my family's important to me, so I enjoy spending time with them. I don't want to talk about any specific activities.
Oh, go on.
No, I'm not.
What do you mean? Come on.
I need some boundaries around what's public.
Yeah, but are you a bowler? Are you? I'm not looking to see you naked. I'm asking you. You know, are you a bowler? Are you a cyclist? You know, what sport do you like? What's your hobby? Let us know a little insight into our Chief Constable. What's your hobby? Have you got any?
I think people are pretty much aware of who I am, of what's important to me. I think I've been pretty public in the year that I've been Chief Constable. I enjoy my family life. I still want some boundaries around privacy and that, but I'm enjoying this job. I relish it, and I feel hugely honoured to have been given it.
See, if you don't tell me, I'm just going to put it about that you like Ludo or something.
Make it up as you go along, Stephen, like you normally do.
Thank you for coming in. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's the Chief Constable for Northern Ireland, George Hamilton, this morning.